This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Allahumma salli ala al-habib Muhammad ya Rabbi salli.
Assalamu alaikum. A'udhu billahi min shaitan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Inna alhamdulillah wa bihi nasta'in. Wa salatu wa salam ala Sayyid al-Mursaleen wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. They have this thing that's going to tell me when to stop talking, which is great. Or when I'm going to die. I'm not sure what this is sign. First of all, two pieces of news. One, I saw Christian Bale yesterday in a restaurant, and he's not any taller than me, which is good news. Second issue, I saw in the airport the other day the New York NYPD police chief, and I said, I really appreciate what you said regarding Muslims. It was very courageous. And then his assistant said he didn't even have to think about it. I didn't bring up the whole surveillance thing, but, let bygones be bygones. Okay. Oh, man, that's weird looking at myself look at something. Is this the PowerPoint working? There we go. So I know this may be a weird beginning of this day, but I'll do my best. There's something that a very fascinating study I came across about 2 years ago, author discrimination between the Holy Quran and the Prophet's statements. This is by an Algerian scholar. He's a scholar of computational linguistics, I think. And so this is actually a really interesting study. And basically what he did is he looked at the Quran, and he looked at Sahih al-Bukhari, and he analyzed the number of times certain words are used, how phrases are used. He did so in a computational linguistics way that I don't understand. But the end result was that, surprise, surprise, the two books come from two different speakers. Now, I think that's not a big surprise for Muslims. It's certainly nice to know. But what I thought, what really interested me was, and by the way, here's just an example of, for example, hadith words present in the Quran, hadith words absent in the Quran, Quran words present in the hadith. So you can see there's actually a tremendous difference in the words that are used between the Quran and the hadith. But that's not what interested me about this study, or what it made me think about. What it made me think about was that the hadith corpus really has its own style of language. And this is something that you notice, even if you don't have a lot of experience reading hadith, but it's something that you'll get a sense of very quickly, which is that the Prophet, alayhi salam, really has his own way of speaking. And although, obviously, even in like a book like the Sunan of Ibn Majah, some scholars like Adh-Dhahabi said that up to a quarter of the hadiths and Sunan of Ibn Majah are unreliable. But when you look even at a book like Abu Dawud or Sahih Bukhari, Sahih Muslim, you do get a very strong sense that the Prophet speaks in a certain way. He has a certain way of speaking. And that's actually one of the, as I get older and think about these things in different ways, one of the things that for me is a really strong indication of the overall authenticity of the hadith tradition, the overall reliability of the hadith tradition, is that there is a consistent mode of style of speech, an idiom of expression in the hadith corpus. Of course, lots of individual hadiths can be unreliable or even forged, but overall, when you have this strong sense of stylistic continuity and homogeneity, I think that's a very strong indication of reliability. So, one of the things that I find very interesting, and this it's very interesting, it's important, but it also presents problems, is when you say the Prophet has a certain way of speaking, alayhi salam, well, what is that way of speaking? And the fact of the matter is, I think one of the major characteristics of the way the Prophet speaks, alayhi salam, is he speaks in the language of hyperbole. For those of you who don't know what that means, you can look it up on your phones or something right now. Hyperbole means, in effect, you exaggerate. We actually oftentimes communicate with each other in a language of hyperbole. I mean, if you go around always speaking accurately to your friends, you're not going to have very interesting conversations. So when people are upset, they say, this is the worst thing that ever happened to me, or I just saw the coolest thing ever, or I'm so hungry, I'm literally going to starve to death in 5 minutes if I don't eat something. That's how we speak to each other. And this is not uncommon for human beings to speak. What's interesting about the way the Prophet speaks to alayhi salam is that he doesn't speak like a lawyer. So I think it's interesting because we're oftentimes you know, we think about Sharia and Islamic law. We think about the way in which we derive very specific rules or very specific tenets of faith from the Quran and from the words of the Prophet, alayhi salam. So oftentimes we think about the Prophet, alayhi salam, as this legal, as a shari', the lawgiver. But that's not the way he spoke. Sometimes he did, especially when he was speaking as a judge, when he was ruling on a case or talking about, you know, exactly how much inheritance someone should get or exactly how much compensation somebody owed for an injury. But when he's speaking, most of the time he's speaking as a prophet, as a preacher, as someone who's inspiring followers. And if you think about this, he's from 610 until 622 of the Common Era when the Prophet makes the hijrah to Medina and sets up his community. He's not a lawyer. He's not a legal figure. He's an inspirational leader who's convincing and inspiring a group of followers who are living under oppressive persecution of the Quraysh elite. And if you think about this, no one is gonna. Have you ever heard of a lawyer, you know, starting a religious movement? I don't know. I'd have to look into that. But I'm, you know, lawyers are not very. Nasser is my friend, who's a law student. Maybe he won't be like this. But you know, you're not gonna get really excited listening to a lawyer speak. They're gonna say, "I was substantially convinced by a compelling argument that that certainly seemed to mitigate." You know, things like that. You're gonna start hearing things like that. No one's going to go and risk being tortured and killed for a belief when someone's speaking to him like that. The Prophet, when he speaks in a language that's meant to make a point. It's meant to impress upon you the import of what he's saying, the import of the message he brings. So Muslim scholars are in this kind of ironic situation where they're trying to derive oftentimes very specific legal rulings from language that is not legalese, that is not the language of a lawyer a lot of the time. So you can see Muslim scholars, even in the very early period of Islam, going back to the generation of the companions and the successors, you see them developing these filters. They're sort of like legal filters for processing prophetic speech. And I want to give some examples of that. I mean, a great example of this is oftentimes, you know, you'll come across hadiths that say, for example, in Sahih Muslim, أفضل الأعمال, the best of actions is doing your prayers on time, followed by obedience to your parents. Or you'll see in Sahih Bukhari, the Prophet saying, the worst of people is the person who is insistent stubborn in argument. So the best of deeds is prayer on time. But then in Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim, you find another hadith. The best of deeds, خير أحب الأعمال إلى الله أدومها. The deeds that are most beloved to God are deeds done consistently over time. Whatever, like the best workout is the one you stick to, basically, right? So you have the Prophet saying the best deeds is prayer on time, then being good to your family. In Musnad of Ahmad ibn Hanbal, the Prophet says the best deeds are striving in the path of God. So which one is it? Or the worst deed is the worst deed really being inveterate and stubborn in your argumentation? Is that worse than murdering somebody? Is that worse than shirk? So the Prophet doesn't say this is a good thing to do, this is a bad thing to do. He says this is the best thing to do, this is the worst thing to do. And so when Muslim scholars look at these hadiths, they take them all together and they say, wait a second, how do we make sense of this? And there were a couple of different approaches they took. One is to say the Prophet would say what the person he was speaking to needed to hear. So if someone comes to you who's a good person but is inconsistent in following through, maybe the Prophet would say to them, the best deed is the one done consistently. If someone comes to the Prophet who's a very good person, but he doesn't do his prayers on time or her prayers on time, he might say the best deed is prayers done on time. So one approach is to say he's saying this to the person in order to encourage them in the way that they need. The second possibility is simply that this means that this is amongst the best things you can do, or this is amongst the worst things you can do. So I think this is important because I can imagine young Muslims or even old Muslims saying, I'm very confused because I'm reading this hadith book and it says, you know, the Prophet's saying that two or three different things are the best thing you can do. So how does that work? I mean, this doesn't seem very accurate. This what's the best thing you can do? It has to only be one thing. This is something that Muslim scholars were aware of in the very beginning of Islam, and they understood that either this means he's talking to a specific person, giving them what they need to know, or that these things he's saying are amongst the most important things. Why is he doing this? Because no one is going to listen to you if you say, you know, you're not going to impress upon somebody the point you're trying to make by saying, this is I suggest this, or this is a good thing to do. Maybe if you're really intelligent and refined like me, you will be able to appreciate that. Someone said, this is a good thing to do. I recommend this. But if you're a Bedouin or an Arab who's illiterate and who lives in a very rough culture, people need to really hammer points home. This is the best thing you can do. This is the worst thing to do. Okay, the second thing, and the prophet making point, is what's called zajr. This is very common in hadith. It's very, very common. Zajr. Zajr means to rebuke somebody or to chastise somebody. So oftentimes the prophet's language, especially when he's talking about something he doesn't approve of, he speaks very harshly. He speaks very harshly. And this means you really have, this is a very important filter that Muslim scholars developed, which is, I call it the zajr filter. So, and I remember, you know, a Muslim came up to me when I think I was in Pittsburgh, and he said, you know, I heard this hadith in the khutbah, and I'm very, like, it shakes my faith. It makes me unsure about my faith. And the hadith's in Sahih Bukhari, and the language is complicated, so I'll just paraphrase it. Basically, the Prophet says, alayhi salam, I would, if I could, I would kindle a fire, and then I would do the call to prayer. And I would go and I'd see the people who didn't go to the mosque to pray. And if they didn't go, I'd burn their houses down. That's effectively what it says. And so this young Muslim came to me and he said, I don't understand this. The Prophet is saying he's going to burn people's houses down if they don't go to the mosque to pray after the adhan. I mean, he was, you can see, like, how is this... this misdeed, even if it's not the best thing to do, how does this warrant the severe punishment? Now, if you look at the way Muslim scholars discuss this hadith, none of them took this literally, as far as I know. No Muslim scholar took this literally, as far as I know. First of all, the Prophet didn't do that. Right? He could, I mean, he's the leader of the community. If he wanted to, he could go and burn people's houses down. He could go tell Omar bin al-Khattab, Omar, go burn that guy's house down, and that guy's house down, and that guy's house down, and he would have done it. But he never did that. Second of all, at the end of the hadith, the Prophet says, if one of you received an invitation to a dinner with juicy, fatty lamb meat, wouldn't you go? So he goes from talking about potentially burning people's houses down, and then he makes this point of, When you hear the call to prayer, it's like you're being invited to a dinner, to a tasty dinner with luscious, fatty, delicious food. Wouldn't you take that invitation? Wouldn't you accept that invitation? And so if you're talking about burning someone's house down literally, you're not going to then follow that by making an analogy to accepting a dinner invitation. So Muslims have always understood, this is the Prophet doing zajr. He's rebuking people. He's saying, When I hear people not going to the mosque, when they hear the call to prayer, it makes me so angry, because they're missing out. They're missing out on an invitation that's been given to them. And I don't know. I mean, this is just my thought. I have no evidence for this. Just my own impression. I almost have this image of the Prophet, this first part almost being said as sort of in a light way, almost in a joking way. You know, so if I were to say to one of my students, you know, sometimes when I see people using semicolons, it makes me I want to go to them and take their computer and just smash it against the table. And they know I'm joking, but they're getting the point that, you know, you really shouldn't use semicolons so often. That's a point you all need to keep in mind. There's something about your generation, you think semicolons are supposedly, you know, take the place of periods. So this is a very important point, very important. And you see this in another hadith, also regarding prayer, where the Prophet says, if any of you in Sahih Bukhari, if any of you go to pray, then put a sutra, a divider between you and the people in front, you know, in the mosque or passing around. And if somebody wants to yujazi, come between you, your hands while you're praying, put your hand out. فَلْيَدْفَعْهُ. And if the person refuses and they keep trying to go in front of you, فَلْيُقَاتِلْهُ. Then fight him. فَإِنْهُ شَيْطَانٌ. Indeed, that person is the shaitan. Now, if you take that hadith literally, it means that you would, in the middle of your prayer, say, then you say, okay, still going to work. And then you say, okay, now it's time. I break my prayer. And then I actually fight the guy. That's literally what it means. Now, as far as I know, I have not found any Muslim scholar who actually says you should do that. Any Muslim scholar in 1,400 years, I haven't come across anybody who says that you should actually fight the person. Why? Because they know from other hadith, first of all, they know that nothing breaks your prayer. So, person walks in front of you, it doesn't break your prayer. A woman walks in front of a man, doesn't break their prayer. Nothing breaks your prayer. I mean, for the vast majority of Muslim scholars, some Muslim scholars say, you know, like a black dog passing in front of you break your prayer. But the person passing in front of you is not going to break your prayer. What is going to break your prayer is you breaking your prayer so that you can get in a fight with somebody. That is going to break your prayer. So if the objective here is for you to complete your prayer, why would you purposely break your own prayer to engage in active violence with another Muslim? So nobody took this seriously. It simply means they said, okay, what does this mean then? What does it mean when the Prophet says fight them? It means, you know, push back harder. If they're really trying to walk in front of you, you know, put your arm out hard. Don't just let them walk by. Put your arm out hard. Let them know that they're doing something wrong. So that's the kind of example of hyperbole here. And the last point, I can't remember if I had another slide after this or not. No, that was just one of the examples I was going to make. No. Oh, yeah, okay, there we go. Sorry, I just want to make another point after this. The final thing, it's very, very common in the Hadith tradition, is you'll see examples of what Muslim scholars deemed al-kufr al-asghar, or lesser kufr. So there's kufr al-akbar is actually becoming a kafir, actually becoming an unbeliever. It's doing something or believing something that actually means you're no longer Muslim or removes you from the fold of Islam. So if I start to believe in another prophet after the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ, or I start worshiping the devil or something, that would remove me from the fold of Islam. Now, what you find much more commonly referred to in the Quran and in the Hadiths is what Muslim scholars call al-kufr al-asghar. This is an act that in and of itself is the type of thing an unbeliever would do, but it doesn't make you an unbeliever. It's sort of like a little incident of kufr that your conduct manifests. But it doesn't mean you're a kafir. It just means that you're at that moment, your action and your belief are out of sync. It's sort of like a level of hypocrisy. And you find this very commonly in the hadith tradition where the Prophet will say something, for example, alayhi salatu wasalam, hadith in Sunan Abu Dawud, man ghasha falaysa minna, whoever cheats is not from amongst us. If you take that literally, it means whoever cheats or pays a bribe is not from amongst the Muslims, so he's not Muslim. Or man hamila alayna silah falaysa minna, whoever carries weapons against us, he's not from amongst the Muslims. But we know we can't take these hadiths literally because the Quran says, إِذَا فِيَتَانْ مِنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ قَتَلَ. If two different parties from amongst the believers fight, then try and reconcile between them. If Muslims fighting with each other with weapons makes one of the, you know, makes them no longer Muslims, why is the Quran referring to the two parties from amongst the believers who are fighting? They're still believers. And we know that the companions of the Prophet fought two different civil wars against each other after the Prophet's death. And they are still all Muslims. So we know this is not literal. Again, this is sort of the language of Zajr. This is, the filter that Muslim scholars set up for that particular phrase, whoever does XYZ is not from amongst us, is this is not, whoever does XYZ is acting like somebody who is not a Muslim. It doesn't mean they're not Muslim. They're still Muslim. Okay. I also just wanted to, this is kind of a different, actually it's the same point, but I was just reading the other day this really annoying article by actually a guy who's ex-Muslim. And he said, and we're all aware of this. It's constantly coming up now since the whatever started in the Middle East started, which is, he said, you know, the Islam scriptures are inherently violent, and as long as Muslims sit there and read their scriptures, basically you're gonna have jihadi organizations, which I think is ridiculous. First of all, because the people in Iraq and Syria were reading the Quran for 1,400 years, and they're reading hadiths for 1,400 years, and ISIS only started in 2013. In fact, ISIS, the organization it started from, began in 2003 or 2004, and it wasn't started by the Quran. It was started by the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq and the destruction of all the institutions and economy and government of that country. So I know, you know, I was talking to my wife about this the other day, and I was saying, we're always so stressed out. I feel like a lot of stress all the time. What's going on? And then I said, you know what? It's not normal every day to wake up and all you hear all day about is how your religion is terrible and how you're a suspect and how you're a cancer and how all this other stuff. I mean, that's not normal. At least not for me, right? I'm not used to waking up every day and having people tell me watching TV how my religion is terrible. That's not normal. That's very stressful. And it really is going to, if you need to be aware of that, because especially young Muslims, I feel really bad. You know, I'm older, I've traveled, I'm jaded, whatever, I don't care about things anymore, I don't listen to the media. When you're young and really impressionable, this stuff is going to start pressing in on you. You have to be aware. This is real stress. It's a real emotional stress for you. And you have to be strong in your faith. And you can't listen to people make bad arguments. You have to know how to identify bad arguments. When someone says, all the stuff that's happening in the world today with ISIS and this San Bernardino and all this Belgium, this is because of the Quran or because of the Hadiths or because of Islam. You just have to keep one thing in mind. People and Muslims in Europe, they had the Quran before last summer. Okay, they had Hadiths before last summer. And they weren't doing anything. Okay, then ISIS said, we're going to, you know, U.S. and its allies started attacking ISIS. And then ISIS said, we're going to attack you in your homelands. And then sure enough, that's exactly what happened. So this is about a particular conflict that has its political causes that didn't need to happen. It's not about the religion of Islam. It's not about the scriptures of Islam. Because there's 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. And even if you take the largest number of all the Taliban and all of Boko Haram and all of ISIS and all these groups, and you add all this together and you divide that by 1.6 billion Muslims, you know the number you get? I calculated 0.006%. 0.006%. Absolutely statistically insignificant. So if there's some problem with the Quran or the Sunnah of the Prophet, if Muslims reading it just can't understand it properly and are inevitably to engage in violence, why is it that statistically no Muslims actually engage in acts of violence in the name of their religion? This is the best, single best argument against what you constantly come across, this idea that somehow your religion, something in its original foundational scriptures, is violent, and like a virus, it's going to spread through the Muslim community. It's just not true. And then, you know, this article I was reading, which really made me angry, the guy also said, and then Islamic history is full of violence. Islamic history is full of violence. And then I looked at, there's this great map. I wrote it on my website. Dr. Jonathan Brown? Jonathan A.C. Brown? I can't remember. Either Dr. Jonathan Brown, Dr. Jonathan A.C. Brown.com. This is a map. Someone did a map of all the different battles in world history. Does anyone notice any, I don't know, it's like it's focused and is that the Muslim world? I think, is that the Islamic world there? No, that looks more like Europe and North America. Let's do this. Let's go back to the time of Islamic civilization. So let's say the time of the death of the Prophet until, let's just say, around 1800. Let's try that. Oh, still really focused on Europe. So again, Islamic history is not full of violence. Muslims are people. Muslims fight wars. Muslims get upset about things. Muslims are greedy. Muslims, you know, fight with their siblings about who's going to come to power. No one's going to deny that. But the fact of the matter is that the most human blood shed is not shed by Muslims. And I don't blame any particular civilization. I don't think anyone's being judged by this. But it's inaccurate to say that Muslim history is somehow exceptionally violent. Jazakumullah khair.